Thank you for joining this afternoon's program of At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. Going to start today's show with a thank you to our sponsor, the Barter House, who is a proud support of the Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. The Barter House works with family vineyards and small bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. Committed to sustainable agriculture and artisanal production, the Barter House offers outstanding wines at a wide range of price points to retailers, restaurateurs, and private collectors. To learn more about the Barter House, please visit them on the web at www.thebarterhouse.com or call them at 917-463-3076. And another phone number for our listeners today to tap into my guest, who is a wealth of knowledge. Please give us a call at 718-497-2126. And we'll start off with the Week in Wine recap. In recent news, while protests in France this week against the government's new retirement reform law have turned violent and intense throughout the country, the Champagne region has also taken to a legal battle to prevent the French National Atomic Agency from dumping nuclear waste near its vineyards. According to French press reports, the CIVC has asked the administrative court in Châlons-en-Champagne to cancel permission granted to Andra in August 2006 to continue storing low-level radioactive waste at its facility in Soulan. Greenpeace released a report showing that low levels of radioactivity from Andra's site in Normandy have seeped into groundwater used by the farmers. The CIVC told Decanter.com that it could not comment on the current court case or what has been doing to address the issues since 2006, which has led some to believe in France that they want to distance themselves from this issue lest it harm relations with local politicians. And in the crop report, the PressDemocrat.com reported yesterday of the harvest conditions in Sonoma County. Sonoma has been beaten down with rain this season. Wet weather is bearing down on Sonoma, and impending raining forecast is forcing winemakers to kick harvest into full gear. Any more moisture at this point brings the threat of mold outbreak. And with unusually foggy and cooler summer, the development and ripening of grapes was already slowed until a sudden spike in hot temperatures in August caused grapes to ripen very fast. The county's production is expected to be about 20% below average, a very difficult season for grape growers, with the most recent sentiment being pick it or lose it. We will take a short break and be back after the segment with Andrew Bell of Wine Symphony and the president of the American Sommelier Association, so stay tuned. You are listening to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network, heritageradionetwork.com, and I'm going to repeat the phone number of our studio, which I misspoke about earlier. So the phone number is 718-497-2128. So for listeners, please call in with any questions for my guest today, Andrew Bell. Welcome.
Thank you very much. How are you doing, Erin?
Very well, thank you. So as I mentioned briefly before, Andrew is the president of the American Sommelier Association and as well owns an importing and distribution company called Wine Symphony. So I know that you've been in the industry and a very important man in the industry in the wine world for many years, and a hard man to pin down. So I'm super thrilled to have you here in the studio today.
Thank you. Where are we again? We're in Brooklyn. I'm sorry, Brooklyn.
We are in Brooklyn, which for some reason today, as I mentioned, walking into the studio, it does smell like a horse stable. So they could be up to something, like the folks at Roberta's always are.
They're probably drinking Cote du Rhone.
Exactly.
I think it smells great here, fellas.
Good, good, good. So tell us a little bit about the American Sommelier Association and when it began.
Wow. So I don't know. I think it began a very long time ago. The 90s. I moved back to New York in 96 from Paris. Back to New York. I used to live in San Francisco. I grew up in Long Island. So I'm sort of from Brooklyn, just a little further west.
Okay.
East. The ASA was founded in 98. I started the New York chapter in 99. We were a spinoff of a group that's still very much functioning and doing great work called the Sommelier Society of America, which is still based in New York as well. We want to teach, and we want to create a culture of wine service and wine knowledge in a way, hopefully, that makes it very interesting for people to pick up a book and a bottle of wine at the same time.
Great. So you had said before that in the 1954, it was a unionized sort of...
The legend goes that in 54 or 56, there were two Italian cats working at the 21 Club who weren't being treated well by management. Previous management, obviously. And they created a union, a syndicate, to try to protect themselves from, you know, working practices and hours and stuff like that. And it morphed over 20, 30 years into an academic organization. So now it's left its whole union side. It's got nothing to do with the current 21 Club operations. And it became the Sommelier Society of America, which the ASA was born out of in about 98, 99.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of your role, I know that you play a host of as an educator to both people in the wine trade and those in consumers and just wine enthusiasts in general. So how have you seen the American Sommelier Association develop over the past decade here in New York?
Well, I think that our development has been part and parcel with the consumer and the trade's interest in knowing more profoundly the wine, water, coffee, tea service in a restaurant environment, so that the way that we've expanded and evolved is a function of what the demand of the population has been.
Sure.
I think that wine knowledge, or the desire for wine knowledge, has grown exponentially, mm-hmm. from both the professional need and the consumer's own desire. It used to be wine still has this taboo to it, that if you don't know what you're talking about at wine, you can be the smartest person in the room and the biggest idiot. And it's, you know, so we're trying to promote that it's agricultural, it's grapes.
Right.
You know, most farmers, when they farm anything, unless it's super industrial, are sustainable. They're organic in nature in terms of, you know, you can't grow grapes. And grapes is a plant. It's a vine. It's, you don't just grow it, pull it out, and replant it. You're constantly nurturing it. So you can't do anything that's going to upset the stasis of the soil. You're constantly trying to nurture the soil to give the plant as much as it can. The vine itself is something that grows better in poorer soil, nutrient poor, mm-hmm. so that the roots develop themselves. You know, the association has grown pretty much like a vine. You can say we're a 10-year-old, 15-year-old vine.
Right.
With much more firm roots in the industry and in the tri-state area especially.
I like that analogy.
It just came to me.
yeah, right.
It's this wonderful Italian wine we're drinking, I think.
Yes, this is a Pignoletto. The producer is San Vito. And this was brought to us by our sponsor today, Barter House.
Shout out to Barter House.
Yep. And Andrew's going to also break out something from his collection from the Jura, which is one of those wine regions that's certainly up and coming. And as we were mentioning before we started the show, consumers' interest and level of knowledge is so much more expanded that people are seeking those values in regions that maybe haven't had as much representation in the States in quite some time. So we will touch upon that wine later and talk a little bit about that producer, which I've had the pleasure of meeting as well, Frederic
Lornay.
Yes. Yeah, so I actually am a graduate of the American Sommelier Association myself, and people ask me...
Cum laude, summa.
if I were to imagine where my sorority would be placed from the American Sommelier Association, it probably would be downtown, somewhere near your offices on Broadway. So good job on that. But yeah, I did the viticulture and vinification course for 6 months and then moved on to the blind tasting course. And Andrew was recounting one of my exams before we started the show, where we went through our blind tasting process of 6 wines, that it was in the dense heat of summer in July, and got in front of the microphone. And this was a videotaped experience where I was wearing a long sleeve shirt and didn't realize it wasn't silk, by the way, it was cotton, and sweated down from the pit to the wrist, all down my
perspired
arm. Perspired. And I didn't realize until after I finished the exam and looked down that he had thrown me a t-shirt from one of his wineries that he represented, Viuminette. A little shout out to them as well. And then he shipped me off to Chile to work at Harvest there. After
to pay for the t-shirt.
No, but it was a really excellent experience. I as well had the pleasure of studying in France, and wasn't studying anything related to hospitality, but certainly had an opportunity to visit a lot more wine regions that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to here on the East Coast. So expanded that world of knowledge. And when I came back to New York, just really had to dig around to find a place that had some classes. So that's where that began. And it's been a nice course since.
It was a mere 25 years ago today that all this began.
So the blind tasting course, going back to that, for me, it was a very kind of a pinnacle moment, I think, in my wine career, and just in terms of learning about wine and learning how to taste and how to detect what's in your glass by certain cues that you can get from color and from smell and these aromas. And I think that in an education, it seems a vital part, but as well a little bit of a a difficult thing to try to gauge, to really learn about wine. I mean, tasting is obviously very important and reading is important, but you have your ideas on blind tasting, which I'd love to hear.
Well, it's blind tasting is sort of the crossroads of your ability to analytically pull information out of a glass with your eyes, your nose, and your mouth, and then take all of that data and throw it up against the wall of the profoundness of your theoretical knowledge. So that there's a little bit of gamesmanship and there's a little bit of sportsmanship. But, you know, the first thing I tell people in class is you have to watch CSI, and Miami, New York, Vegas, it doesn't matter, because it's all about the evidence. So it's about empirical data. What do you see for itself? What do you smell? How the basis of your theoretical data come back in is that if you're smelling apple, pear, and quince with these little wafting notes of vanilla, caramel, and butterscotch, that's going to lead you somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Geographically and stylistically, the mm-hmm. apple, pear, and the quince might lead you toward Chardonnay, or it might lead you toward Pinot Blanc. So that, you know, one of the things that you have to do is you have to understand that grapes have their signature aromatically and flavor-wise and texture-wise, and then you have to see all the influences that can change how the grape would express itself otherwise. For example, if you take a cool climate Chardonnay, it will give you these notions of like Granny Smith apple, or maybe in a warmer year, a Macintosh or a Golden Delicious. It may give you a Bartlett pear or an Anjou pear. But then if you throw that puppy into 100% new French oak, you're going to crush a lot of that and come out with vanilla, caramel, and butterscotch.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, the key to blind tasting is trust your senses and then read everything in print or on the web. Because knowing how to describe something is half the challenge. Bringing it home is coalescing all this information into a place and time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of fun. It's fun because it demystifies everything that we're afraid of about wine, and that's speaking intelligently. Wine, at its very base, is a grape. It's agricultural, and the grape's job is to express the soil
mm-hmm.
and the climate.
Mm-hmm.
And the wooden part of the vine is a conduit to get these sort of very banal but regionally specific things to manifest themselves in the grape.
And speaking of Chardonnay, as you are touching upon this, there's many people who I've tasted with who might not be in the industry, but are certainly enthusiasts, and they say, oh, no, I hate Chardonnay, I hate Chardonnay. And they might be referring to a certain expression of it with the overexcited use of oak, for instance.
Yes, I like that, overexcited use of oak.
But if you were to show them something and not tell them that could be a Chardonnay from Burgundy, for example, they might like that. So it's just, as you mentioned, the winemakers kind of goal, I'd say more so now than ever in these days, is to really let that variety express itself and where it's from, based on being able to have a classic sort of representation of that wine style.
There's an organization in California called ABC, and it's not alcohol beverage control. It's called Anything But Chardonnay.
Sure.
And I've always believed, and
I didn't realize it was an actually organization.
Oh, no. This is Grape Growers and Winemakers. And I don't think their problem is necessarily with Chardonnay as a varietal. It's expression in the new world when there's this belief that overripeness, high alcohol, tropical fruit, and then butter, sweet cream, Devonshire cream, that these are all notions of a varietal, as opposed to a varietal in a region with a certain temperature signature and then a style of winemaking. You're going to see, you know, for those of you out there who love heavy tropical fruit, rich, creamy, buttery, toasty, vanilla, caramel, butterscotch Chardonnays, your days are numbered. The California grape growers, the new world grape growers, you know, it could be sustainable and carbon footprint. You know, you got to kill a tree to make a barrel. So if you're going to use new oak every year, you got to get another tree. So people are using oak less.
Right.
They're reusing oak. They're you know, a barrel can last 10 or 20 years if you're not looking for anything out of the barrel except oxygen and this porous relationship that the contents inside the barrel have with the air outside the barrel.
Right.
So as we grow as a country, because we've only really been making commercial wine for 40, 50 years, you know, the Romans were 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. We got a long way to go to catch up. And all the grapes that most of you know that you consume here in the United States, they weren't here 150 years ago. They were brought from Europe.
Sure.
So, you know, we're really sort of infants in this whole process. And we've made billions of dollars of industry out of it. So we're smart infants. But in terms of, you know, I think that if the listeners understand, and I know most of them do, that you only get one shot at making a wine every year. You know, it's not like you can mess it up and say, all right, we're going to start all over again. No, you got to wait a whole nother agri cycle. And, you know, Mother Nature is a fickle woman. She's often not very, you know, California, oh, every vintage is great. No, every vintage is hot as hell. So, you know, then you have fires in the south of California that impact the grapes in the north because the wind's out of the south. I mean, there are any number of things. I tell students in class here, it's pouring rain during class. And they're like, oh, this is horrible. I'm like, well, think how they feel on Long Island where the grapes are. You know, they're supposed to be picking right now.
Right.
So if you're wondering how 2009 is going to be, look at your weather in Manhattan. But then say, thank you, New Jersey, because New Jersey sticks out into the ocean a little bit, blocks some of the weather coming out of the south. Shout out to Staten Island. They're sticking out a little bit too. They protect Manhattan from all this nasty weather. And then Long Island protects a lot of the East End because the weather will hit Central Island before it travels east and north and quiet the storm a little bit. And these are, I mean, it's kind of geeky talking about all this, but it's like these little things that impact
all
the quality of a fruit.
Other. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's just grapes. Don't forget that.
Well, but it's interesting. I recently tried a Chardonnay from a winemaker from Porter Creek, and he's making a Chardonnay, which a lot of people...
In Russian River?
Want to call Burgundian, and he's like, don't mistake this for Burgundian. This is California Chardonnay.
Right.
So it's that kind of return to letting that grape variety express the California soil and it being very inherent to that as opposed to masking it with other qualities such as oak. So.
Right.
I know that Oregon oftentimes gets the same kind of association with, respect to more of a European hand. But that's just because it's the restraint used, which should really let that grape, which is very simple, kind of show its character.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
With respect to women winemakers, do you feel that there is a generalization with them having a lighter hand or a more feminine touch with respect to winemaking?
Have you ever shaken the hand of a woman winemaker? There's nothing light
there's
or feminine
nothing light about it.
I mean, they may use Jergens all day long. Jergens is not a paid sponsor of this show. Or hand lotion. But I mean, you know, no, absolutely not. I think that I think that wines are often a mirror of the person growing the grape and making the wine.
Mm-hmm.
That what you think about your favorite wines, if you were to look at the people directly associated with the growing of the grape and the actual making of the wine, that you would feel like you've met them already in Plutarch's lives.
Mm.
You know, that you've come across their personality by consuming their beverage.
That's interesting, too, with respect to thinking about dog owners and how their dogs sometimes mimic what they are in personalities.
Most people who own dogs, I find they look very similar to their dog.
I know.
I, on the other hand, have married and have gotten much better looking because my wife is gorgeous.
Of course, yes.
So no, I don't think, I think that if a female winemaker's personality is on the softer side,
mm-hmm.
then she will be looking to grow grapes that will express her.
Right.
And that it's not... You know, I know plenty of female winemakers making grapes that are very fragile and very delicate and difficult to work with, like Pinot, and making these massive, structured, you know, beautiful wines that mm-hmm. need time. And you and they represent the woman who's behind it, but not necessarily like the varietal Pinot, which is considered a lighter, more spicy, you know, it's not as big as Cab or, you know, whatever. It's, no, I don't think that, we're just going to keep it as a no.
Okay, gotcha. Well, on that note, we are going to take a short break, and then I want to come back and talk about your career as a sommelier or wine director at Guy Savoy in Paris and how the service industry has changed a bit since then.
Sweet.
Welcome back to At the Root of It with my guest this afternoon, Andrew Bell, the president of the American Sommelier Association, as well as Wine Symphony, which is his importing and distribution company, and also which imports this wine that we're drinking, Frédéric Lornay, from the Arbois in the Jura region of France.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, we could go on about this wine, or I'm really actually curious to talk a bit about your experience as a sommelier in Paris, at least a decade ago, and how you've seen the industry change and the pendulum swing to a degree with respect to service and restaurants. So you can touch upon that. That'd be great.
Okay, so everybody just, you know, sit back, get a bottle of wine and a glass, and we'll be back in about an hour. So, no, Guy Savoy was fabulous. I lived in Paris for a little bit. I have, like most... second generation. I have Irish citizenship, so I was allowed to work there legally. Anybody who wants to know, call the station.
Did not know that.
So I'm working in this 2-star Michelin restaurant, and you know the most high end restaurant I'd worked at in the past during college was a place called Splendidos in San Francisco, in Embarcadero 4. So I was used to a little bit of, you know, upper crust, sort of very polished service, but never trained, and I was scared out of my toenails. So I'm starting to work there, and it's all very sort of methodical. Everybody weighs 2 pounds. They all look like Twiggy from England, because you can eat 1,000 pounds worth of calories and you'll burn it off in one service. So it was interesting because the stress level of the perfection in the dining room is equal to what I imagine Chef Savoy demanded from the kitchen.
Mm.
And I mean, you messed up, you paid severely. So this is where I'm coming from after, you know, being the California boy for 4.5 years, 5 years when I finished my studies. And I think I moved to Paris in 1862.
It's still the same as it was then.
Yes. So coming back to the States, you know, I was a little bit of a snob. Some people might argue that I'm still am, but I try not to be. And that, you know, when you get to New York, it's people don't own the building where their restaurant is always, that, you know, rent is a big sort of economic weight that you need to worry about in order to keep the restaurant alive. So, you know, whereas if you go to Guy Savoy, it's kind of like what Alain Ducasse, Chef Ducasse, tried to do when he came to the Essex House. It's one seating, it's 62 people, it will be perfect. Mm. And, you know, that's very Michelin, it's very sort of French service, and he clearly did it well because he's still here and thriving. But he had a rough go of it in the beginning.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, and I don't want to say the pretense of service because it sounds a little bit too detrimental. You know, great service is amazing and it's life-changing experience in a restaurant. But, you know, we kind of take the same amount of time in this country in major markets to eat as we do to fill our car with gas. You know, right. You fill the tank and then you can work for another 150 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So, or 300 miles, depending upon if it's a hybrid.
You fill the tank while you're having your drinkable yogurt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it, so I think that, you know, we want to be a culture of, you know, the peace and the lifestyle of Europe. The food is certainly there.
Mm-hmm.
We have plenty of very successful, very talented chef-born, French-born, American-born, French-trained, Italian-trained. I mean, gastronomy in the United States is, it's amazing. It's amazing. And,
yeah.
And no other country has sort of a bigger piece of that than we do. And we're a growing, young economy, hospitality and gastronomically. But we just don't like taking 2 or 3 hours for a meal. I mean, we'd love to, but we do it when we're on vacation somewhere else.
Sure.
You know, if we got to get back to the desk, we got to get back to sales, we got to get back to whatever it is we're doing. So the service has sort of morphed into the consumer's demand for brevity.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you're serving a table of four, it's classically influenced with a little bit of Williamsburg
urban
speed.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, so, you know, we'll talk to you while serving,
mm-hmm.
and which will sort of make you forget we just spilt wine on the table. But at the same time, we won't have spilled so much that you're missing a significant volume of wine.
Right.
And, you know, we'll apologize and maybe you'll get a free dessert out of it. But we're not, you know, that stress level, I think, is less. And it's more about, how quickly can we get you your food? Because your time with us is about 90 minutes.
Right.
And that's, I'm talking 4-star, you know, New York Times restaurant down to no star satisfactory restaurants. Mm. It's not about the rating of the restaurant. You know, certainly when you get to the Daniels and the John Georges and the Ducasses and the Essex Houses, you have a level of expectation that you're going to be here for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. But sometimes the food comes out a little quicker and sometimes you eat a little bit quicker and you can get on with the rest of your night.
Hmm.
You know, the destination nature of eating is not a Manhattan thing.
Right.
And I think that, you know, you spoke earlier about women winemakers. Women in the wine business on the hospitality side, holy tamale.
Fire starters.
It's just, the percentage of female students has quadrupled in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And I've always had this theory personally that women are more well suited for the job of a sommelier because most of them have been playing with mom's perfume since they could get up to the level of the dresser.
Mm-hmm.
And so this exposure and this development of the olfactory bulb and this ability to sort of discern between one scent that mom had over another, well, that's what wine's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you add to that a little bit of genius with the theoretical knowledge, you know, women have tested phenomenally better in blind tasting, at least through the American Sommelier Association, than men categorically.
Right.
You know, if you go into a restaurant and you're happy with the service and it was a little bit sloppy, you know, you can always impact that by saying something or the tip. But when they get you your check speedily and you get to where you want to be after dinner quickly, you know, normally most things are relatively forgivable if your clothes aren't soiled.
True. I mean, but I also think that, you know, the other aspect of the service part is that there's with the growing knowledge of the consumer base, how does that affect the person who's on the floor in terms of their job?
Well, I think that the sommelier is the first position to get axed when the economy goes south.
Mm-hmm.
So sommeliers need to be polyvalent.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be an AGM or a GM. They need to run the floor. They need to be willing to close. Even though the sommelier is the financial driving force of the restaurant,
mm-hmm.
or the team of wine sales, let's call it, because not every restaurant will say they have a sommelier. I think that the consumers level at the at American Sommelier, we want to teach the professional to be professional and knowledgeable. You don't need to know everything about wine. You need to know everything about your wine list.
Mm-hmm.
From the consumer's perspective, what we teach is how to deal with the sommelier. Because the sommeliers always had this used car salesman sort of allure.
Sure, they're always going to point you to the higher price bottle, which is not necessarily the case.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, certainly not anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've been living in New York since that was the case.
Right.
You know, there's a desire as a sommelier. Sommeliers are a curator. Mm-hmm. They're a curator of the artwork on display in a restaurant at any given moment via the wine list. That the sommelier didn't do anything to make the wine in most cases, although that's beginning to change as well. All they did was, and it's not no small feat, mind you, they put together a collection that hopefully highlights the chef's food.
Right.
And the food makes the wine better, and the wine should make the food better. The sommelier job is really to create an experience so that you feel you're somewhere else. And it can be this horse-smelling studio we're in that turned into a restaurant, or it can be, you know, a Michelin three-star restaurant somewhere in Ez in the south of France,
mm-hmm.
or in Milan. It's no matter where you are, you have a suspension of your surroundings because you're carried away by the experience, both culinarily, and it's a little bit more so in the United States because when you're in Italy, at least as an American, you're eating Italian food.
Right.
You're not going to a three-star Chinese restaurant.
Haven't seen many, yeah. I wouldn't tup in them if I did.
but it's the fascination with the server knows that if they do their job well, there will be more money in it at the end of the guest's experience
mm-hmm.
because we're still a tip-based economy when it comes to service.
Sure.
The consumer knows that they have the chutzpah, the balls, the ovaries, to actually say what they want and define a price that they're willing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
I want a juicy, fruity Cabernet at $50. Can you hook me up? Because I don't recognize any of them on your list.
Right.
And consumer, when you put the person who's serving you, waitress, waiter, captain, sommelier, to task, if they don't deliver, you have the right to say, this isn't what I wanted.
Right.
And not pay for that bottle of wine. Now, don't be a schlub and, you know, refuse five bottles and then you're already done with the main course and you've been drinking water all night. You know, so have a reasonable expectation of where you are, what the list is, and what you want out of it.
Yeah. I agree completely. Sweet. I think that people should take advantage more often of the person on the floor and show them some gems if they can.
You may find something that's not in print on the list.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? We just got this in. It's $42. It's a little bit less than you wanted to pay. But I think this is exactly what you've described.
Right.
And again, it's like my wife always tells me, communicate.
Exactly. I was speaking to somebody last night about this too, because they said, well, you obviously know when you go into a wine situation or a store or a restaurant and be presented with a list, you must know exactly what you want. And I said, well, you know, I will engage the sommelier just as well, because they could have opened something earlier that day or the 2 days before that I hadn't recently tasted and could be drinking really well. And they have experienced that before me and I'd like to hear it from them first. So, so one other question. I usually think about pairing wine with food that I would be eating in that particular country or that place at that time. Do you generally follow that rule of thumb as well?
In terms of
pairing, in terms of picking a wine with a particular dish, and if that dish has origins in,
like, if you're having
place,
pasta arrabbiata,
yeah,
you're going to drink Italian,
or a lamb stew, and we're looking at the Rhone right now and thinking, mm-hmm. you know, in this kind of.
I think that's a technique that probably came across in blind tasting now. I don't remember if it was when you were taking the, you have to pair food with the wine as part of the exam.
Right.
I always suggest that regardless of where you're eating, that you should certainly think toward the area of wine production if you know where the primary ingredients are from.
Right.
It doesn't mean you have to have New Zealand Pinot Noir with a New Zealand, you know, lamb.
Lamb, right.
You know, or you have to have Nevada wine if you're having Neiman Ranch. I mean,
but something characteristic of region,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, if you look at, I mean, if you're having cassoulet, right? So duck breast and leg with white beans. You go to the Southwest, there's a reason why they eat that all the time.
Absolutely.
Especially
yeah.
in the dead of winter. And their wines are massive.
Yep.
To be able to stand up to cassoulet.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're having a
Cahors,
C-A-H-O-R-S, that, you know, that's a massive Malbec from
duck.
Southwest.
You're eating foie, you know.
Well, but if you have that cow as an aperitif wine, you'll be like, oh my God, what do they do?
Yeah.
So, you know, things change. It's, you drink the wine on its own and then you have it with the food. Hopefully both improve for the consumer's hedonistic pleasure.
Absolutely. Now, what about this wine? Before we wrap up, let's talk about this real quick and think about what we might pair with this from where it's from.
Well, so we're in the Jura, which is south of Alsace and east of Burgundy, and it's very mountainous. It's Jura as in Jurassic, i.e. the park. So it's very old soil. It's a lot of marlstone. This is called Naturé, which is an historical name for the grape Savagnin, S-A-V-A-G-N-I-N, not to be confused with a region in Loire. It's sort of, well, why don't you describe it?
It's okay. I'm on.
You're on the hook. You have 4 minutes. Oh, wait, we only have 30 seconds
Well, it certainly has really nice bright acidity. I get that kind of pear notes to it, a little bit of spice, nice kind of glycerol quality. I imagine there's some extended lees contact there.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So this glycerol thing that Ernst's talking about is like this smooth, silky mouthfeel. That little coating on your teeth when you're done swallowing a wine. You can't say you hate a wine and be just licking your teeth. They're counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. But this is, I mean, that has that, has a really kind of pungent kind of acidity there, a nice sour apple thing going on in the finish.
And it's an 07.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. It's already 2 years in the bottle, 3 years out of the vineyard.
And that speaks to the Jurassic quality of this particular wine.
It's very old. So this grape goes into a wine called Vin Jaune as well, which can age for almost ever. If you think about the acidity, what Aaron's screaming for is something with fat or protein. So tuna, swordfish, salmon, sea bass. One of the local fish to the area, a river fish, is trout, that this wine would pair very well with. Chicken in a cream sauce, believe it or not.
Sure.
There's a lot of pork in the area. So, you know, any sort of salami, the Genoa, or, you know, saucisson, something, a dried sausage that you would have in an apéritif, the fat and sort of the oiliness of that would be balanced out by the acidity here. Not a lot of oak. This is made in a 3,000-liter, 52-year-old barrel.
Yeah,
this year.
Yeah. No, you don't get it on there as well. I mean, at all, you don't necessarily could pick that up.
But the acid, it's a mountainous, cool area that's freezing in the winter. Do not go to the Jura in the dead of winter unless you have thermal underwear, silk, and down. The summer, however, is beautiful, not terribly humid, you know, breezy evenings, warm days in the 80s, never really gets much above 85, and it's unique.
Yeah.
So what Aaron was talking about earlier about, you know, people gravitating sort of toward this region, when I first started bringing these wines in, they weren't here, nobody knew them, and everybody said they'll never sell. They're delicious, funky, and never sell. But then, you know, 8 years ago, Gruner Veltliner became the Rolls Royce of white wine out of Austria, and very affordably so.
Yeah, I mean, it's good.
You know, getting away from Chardonnay, nothing wrong with Chardonnay, but the new world sort of projection of it. This is another varietal that sort of gives you an opportunity to have something that's a foot and a half outside of your comfort zone, but it still have a brilliant sort of culinary Venice experience.
Yeah. And makes people who aren't necessarily, don't necessarily know it all in terms of wine, feel like they're a little bit on the cutting edge of something cool.
Absolutely. Ahead of the curve.
Not that that's anyone's goal, but, you know, it's certainly every day, and I can say this as I imagine you can too, it's a learning experience when it comes to wine. So we're always trying to challenge ourselves and try new things and learn more. So kudos to all those people who do that and do step out a foot and a half outside of their comfort zone to try something different.
That brings us to the Best Sommelier in America competition this April 2011.
Okay.
You got to be in it to win it.
April 2011, you heard that. We'll post that on our website as well for the American Sommelier Association competition for World's Best Sommelier.
America's Best Sommelier.
Okay. The world one is hosted where?
The last one was just, they just had it in Chile.
Oh, okay.
The next one's 3 years from now in Japan, in Tokyo.
Okay. And then additionally, can you point us to the website of the American Sommelier Association?
www.americansommelier.com.
Is it .com?
.com, .org.
Okay, .org, either one.
.andrew Bell.
Got them both. Okay.
I bought them both.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us today. It was
thank
a pleasure.
You.
And thank you to our sponsor, Barterhouse Wines, and to our producer, Jack Inslee and engineer Nat Wiener. So we will see you next week, and hopefully you can join us again, Andrew.
I would love to. Thank you for having me.
El antifaz que tu maldad cubría cayó para exhibir.